Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. The subject for the first half here, little word, big subject. We're going to talk about a biblical perspective on sex. Maggie Carner will join us here in just a moment. A little later in this hour, we'll hear from Uwe Simonetto, our religion roundup. We'll spend the last 25 minutes with him talking about the Pope's visit to Lourdes, the Pope's health, the document on feminism from Cardinal Ratzinger out of the Vatican. We'll also talk about the Muslim situation in Europe, and we'll talk about whether or not the rift that seems to be evident between the Western branch of Islam, the more moderate branch, and the branch that we see in evidence in Islamic countries and in national terrorism, whether that rift is getting bigger or smaller, whether or not Islam as a worldwide phenomenon is being radicalized, or whether or not it will eventually be mellowed to its more moderate form. We'll be talking about that with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International, in about 25 minutes. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Maggie Carner is director of LCMS Life Ministry. She's author of an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled Sex, Little Word, Big Deal. Maggie, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hello, it's great to be here.
What is the general scriptural vantage point when it comes to human sexuality and sex?
Well, it's funny. God actually has a tremendous amount to say about the subject of sex, and I was surprised to find out that he talks about it in every one of his epistles. And when you think about it, that's not really that surprising because he created it, and he's sort of the expert. God designed sex for us to be a wonderfully intimate physical and emotional gift that two people can experience together. But the big thing is that he intended this gift to be shared within a context that he created. And the problem is we often forget that context, those boundaries that he created for us. A lot of people don't realize that God did not create sex for the boundary of love. He created it specifically for the context of total commitment. And when you realize that total commitment is necessary, then you understand that that means marriage.
So while the human animal, to use that word advisedly, is capable of carrying out the act, in any context, God has intended not only the sexual act, but the entire relationship in its fullest sense to be found in and only in marriage.
Exactly. And there's good reason for that. God understands that we live in a very sinful world that's full of disease, and he wants to make sure that we don't live in a life that's burdened by dumb decisions and poor choices that can lead to heartache and responsibilities that we're not ready for, not to mention incurable diseases from sexually transmitted diseases, poverty, and even an early death from some of these diseases. So God says, he lays it all out for us, and he says, I'll give you my boundary that's going to make it easy for you. And my boundary is total commitment, and that means marriage, a monogamous married relationship. And within that context, within that boundary, sex is an awesome thing. It's a wonderful gift that he gives us. But we just need to remember what the context is that he gave it to us for.
Let's talk about, and I think probably the statistics that you quote in the course of your article in Higher Things are enough to make any parent's blood run cold. I got a daughter who is 12, and I look at this statistic that in the next 24 hours, 12,000 teens will contract a sexually transmitted disease. For some of them, it will be their second sexually transmitted, or maybe their third. 30% of those diseases contracted are going to be incurable.
That's frightening, isn't it? When I saw that statistic, it just, I just couldn't believe it, and I had to double check that. But that is accurate, and it's an epidemic, especially with teens these days, and a lot of them are not getting accurate information about what a risk sexuality, being sexually active, is in today's world. You know, when I was, this will tell you how old I am, I graduated from high school in 1981. And when I graduated from high school, one in 18 sexually active teenagers had a sexually transmitted disease, one in 18. Now it's one in three. So the kids today are not playing the same game, you know, at least that I was, you know, back in the old days. And so they have to make sure that they have accurate information about what's going on, just from a health standpoint, let alone the biblical understanding that's necessary here, too.
It seems as culturally a couple things have taken place, Maggie. One, all of the taboos and even some that we didn't think were there have fallen. They're gone in society.
Most definitely.
Those cultural mechanisms that were designed, not consciously, but were designed in the society to protect young people from premarital sex and premature sex, to protect women and young ladies from the opposite sex. They were all sorts of little things in our society. They're all gone. Our kids are living in a world not of, only of unprotected sex, but unprotected, period. Is this why we've seen the age of first sexual contact go from 17 or 18, college age, to 13 and 14, junior high?
I definitely believe that's true. I think in today's world, with the media-savvy world we live in, kids are being constantly exposed to sexual messages at an earlier and an earlier age. I know lots of young kids, you know, even if they're not watching MTV, they've got big brothers and sisters that have it on in the background. And advertising and magazines and TV is constantly telling our kids, you know, to be appealing, you must be sexual or must at least look sexual, which, of course, then tends to desensitize kids to what that sexual message really is. And kids end up getting themselves in trouble at an earlier and an earlier age.
Nowadays, instead of dating, they hook up. And it seems almost a conscious effort to make the sexual experience, be it full-blown intercourse or whatever it is, a matter of the body and the body alone.
Mm-hmm.
The personality isn't even involved. What's going on?
Well, you know, I'm not a teenager, so I can't really get into the hearts and souls of a lot of these kids that are engaged in this kind of behavior. But I just think that I blame it a lot on the media. And the messages that are coming from advertising and even, you know, mail order catalogs these days, you can't open those anymore without seeing the human body as, well, you had said it earlier, as an animal. And if we're going to, communicate the message that we are animals, then people will end up starting to behave like animals. And as Christians, we understand, obviously, that that's not true. And we want our young people to behave as children of God and not as animals, and so it's important that they see themselves in the light of Christ's sacrifice and what he's done for them and feel good about their body, but make sure that they understand that they were bought with a price and that God loves them so deeply that he wants them to avoid all the headaches that an early sexual relationship brings. And, you know, it's just such a perfect plan when you look at it, how God laid it out.
We're talking with Maggie Carner, director of LCMS Life Ministries. She's authored an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled Sex, Little Word, Big Deal. With that hooking up phenomenon, is the first thing when we're talking to the younger generation about sex, and they all think we, of course, know so much about it.
Yeah.
But when we're talking to them as parents or as people working within the church or just in the community, is the first task to convince kids that sex is a big deal?
Oh, definitely. Most definitely. Because every other message that they're getting in society says it's not a big deal, that it's something to play around with, and everybody does it. So we need to help kids understand the realities of what this decision means. I usually start, I don't even start from, you know, because a lot of kids don't want to look at it from a moral viewpoint. So I start, especially if I'm speaking to kids that may not be believers, I start basically from a health standpoint and lay it all out. I lay the facts out, and they're scary. And the kids come away thinking twice about the health risks that are involved. then once their eyes have been opened and they start thinking twice that this is not just a little deal anymore, that it's a big decision, then they start thinking about the moral implications and the gift that God gave them in their sexuality and that it needs to be preserved.
What about the kind of vo-tech education that our kids get in schools when it comes to sex, and in particular sex education? It used to be health class, and the mechanics were not dwelt upon, just the plumbing. But now the mechanics are being taught at an earlier and earlier age, and pretty much just the mechanics.
Well, it depends on what, you know, obviously things differ from school to school. In some schools, I have to give them credit, especially many of our Lutheran schools. I just returned from a couple of youth gatherings full of Lutheran teenagers and did a lot of talking with those kids, and by far and away, the majority of our Lutheran kids that go to Lutheran schools understood the message clearly and correctly, and I felt great about that. But in public schools, there's a lot of public schools that are doing a great job talking about abstinence as being the only safe sex. But then in some other situations, there's some very disappointing programs where kids are taught that safe sex means a condom. And I'm sorry, but that's just not accurate. There are a lot of sexually transmitted diseases, HPV, human papillomavirus in particular, that has nothing to do with the spreading of bodily fluids. So condoms are completely ineffective when it comes to this type of a disease. And, you know, kids need to understand that there's these caveats, that there's no simple answer. You can't just say safe sex, because there is no safe sex unless you're talking abstinence.
The logic, and this is probably in vogue 10 years or 15 years ago, more so than now, but the logic was, look, children are sexual beings from birth, and to deny them full access to all knowledge about matters sexual from the earliest possible ages, and they were talking about kindergarten, would be to raise them in a repressive environment where they're just going to rebel against it, and they're going to find out about it on the streets from someone that they don't know or trust, and the situation will be worse. How would you respond to that?
Well, I'm not sure if I understand your question, but I think what you're saying is, should we or shouldn't we expose kids early on to this type of information? Is that what you're asking?
Well, to respond to the argument that if you don't, they're going to be raised repressed, sexually repressed, and then the end result will be worse than if you just laid all the facts on the table for them when they turn 5 years old.
Yeah. Well, I mean, any good parent, anybody with common sense understands that there's certain things that you bring up to a kid at an appropriate age. You know, and especially in a post 9/11 world, we're all very conscious about what is age appropriate for our children, whether we're talking about terrorism or watching the evening news. I mean, it's the same thing with sex. I mean, parents are the best go-to person when it comes to understanding whether their child is ready to learn about sexuality or not. Parents know each individual child is different, and you may, even within your own family, you know, your kids are different. Parents know that. But I don't think that, you know, I do think it's important to make sure that kids have all the information, clear, correct information, definitely by the early teen years, because you're right, they will hear it out there in the streets. They will hear it, you know, in the locker room or at the lunch table. And so it's important to make sure that parents are open and honest and clearly communicating this information with their kids, and just not necessarily lecturing, but just keeping the lines of communication open during these years, because their kids are processing this stuff constantly. You can almost just see the little gears turning in their heads, and they have a lot of things to deal with as they explore their worldview and how they fit into this big world. And sex is a big part of it at this time in their life. And I think as Christians, it's imperative that we speak to them not only from a health and a risk standpoint, but also from a Christian standpoint that helps them understand that they are adopted as God's children, and that they have this lineage of royalty, and they're important and they're valuable to God and to you as a parent, and that they need to think of themselves that way.
Is abstinence impossible?
Absolutely not. It's you know, and in fact, the more kids I talk to daily, I'm finding more and more kids are committed to that. Once they understand what this big game is that kids are playing out there today, they realize it's a crapshoot, and they're not going to, you know, they're not going to put their lives at risk. And I hear more and more kids saying, hey, this is a cool thing to do. It's not impossible. And as kids are more and more open about it, in fact, at some of the youth gatherings, we had abstinence tattoos that the kids were putting on, and some of them had them on their forehead. You know, they were just being crazy and lighthearted about it, but they were serious, too. They knew that they had made this commitment, and they were going to stick to it. And the more kids are open and honest and talk about it amongst themselves, the more support they have in their decision.
I'm thinking about the kids of the baby boomers, which these are. And the baby boomer generation, not to a person, but by and large, indulged pretty deeply in the sexual revolution. And I wonder what a parent who says, look, I have no authority, moral authority, to talk to my kids about abstinence because I didn't practice it. What would you say to such a parent?
I'd say, if you think you have an open communication with your child, be honest with them. Tell them that. Because if you've been through it, you know the risks and the heartaches. You know the feeling of vulnerability that you were left with after multiple sexual partners. And be honest with them. And I think kids will respect you for that. They'll say, you know, gee, Mom, I didn't realize you knew what you were talking about. So you can look at it from both ways as a parent. If you have a negative experience, open up with your kids and share it with them and let them know that, you know, you've been there and you know the wrong road to take. If you remained abstinent until you were married, share with your kids what a great gift that was that you and your spouse gave to each other. You know, what a glorious wedding gift to give. And tell them, you know, share with them the benefits of that.
So how important is it, Maggie, for not only our kids, but all Christians to know the twofold truth that God invented sex, and he's the author of it, and that he invented it for marriage?
Well, I think it's critical. I mean, God designed us to be monogamous creatures. And of course, society will argue with that. But at our inner core, our inner emotional core, we desire loyalty and truth and complete commitment with one other partner. That's what we desire, and we don't always get it. And sometimes in today's world, people turn that upside down and distort that and end up, because they've been disappointed or they've been rejected, they end up doing the exact opposite. But at our inner emotional core, God designed us to be committed and loyal to one sexual partner. And people know that. People feel, especially kids. Kids are innocent enough to still remember that feeling of wanting loyalty from one person. And so if you explain it to them in that sense, that God designed you this way, that makes sense to them. And I think once you explain, you know, the benefits of this boundary that God set up for us, it makes perfectly good sense. I talk to kids about, you know, a lot of times they think the word boundary is a negative thing. But if you explain it in the sense that certain boundaries are wonderful, for instance, if you go camping and you look at the boundary of the campfire ring around your campfire, that's a good boundary. If that boundary wasn't there, you would have a horrible forest fire on your hands. So fire can be a good thing. It can warm your toes, but it can be a horribly destructive thing if it's outside the boundary. And it's the same way with sex. And if you put it in that context with kids, they understand that the boundary is there for your benefit. It's not there. God is not some, you know, old, mean old guy sitting up in heaven that's trying to ruin your fun. He's there because he loves you, and he gave you this boundary for your benefit and for your joy.
Maggie, before we let you go, tell us a little bit about LCMS Life Ministries.
LCMS Life Ministries is a division of LCMS World Relief and Human Care, and it's a perfect marriage between these two mission outreaches because human care is what Life Ministry is all about. Our mission is to equip pastors and lay people alike with the resources that they need for the lifting up of the sanctity of human life. And we are developing resources daily. We're working on a website that will provide lots of educational resources in a broad spectrum of life issues, from the womb, we're talking cloning, stem cell research, those type of issues, all the way to end-of-life issues. So we're here to support Christians in their walk and to make sure that they have the information that they need. We work cooperatively with Lutherans for Life, and we've had a great working relationship with them. And our job is to make sure that the resources are there and that people know about them.
When you and the website is up and working?
Not yet. We do have a website that I can direct you to, and there's a little bit more information about it there. But we're undertaking some major construction on our Life Ministries website. So that will be up and going shortly. But in the meantime, you can go to lcms.worldrelief@lcms.org.
Now, folks, in either case, you can go to our website, issuesetc.org. And you can go to that website by going to our website, look under the links for with regular guests for Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. You'll find that website. And as soon as possible, we'll also have a link to Maggie Carner and LCMS Life Ministries on our website, issuesetc.org, right there under the links with regular guests link. Maggie Carner, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much for having me.
Maggie Carner is director of LCMS Life Ministries and author of an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled Sex, Little Word, Big Deal. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August. You know, that's something to pray about. Your kids and their future, the way we've been talking about it this last 25 minutes. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August is all about prayer, about Christian prayer, real Christian prayer. Not a Christian striving to be heard by God because of their words or their effort, but the kind of prayer that God hears and answers for Christ's sake alone. The book is called Is God Listening? And it answers that question affirmatively in a Christ-centered, cross-focused way. It's by Andrew Steinman, author of our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August. It's $9.99 plus shipping and handling. Visit our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. You'll find information there. Or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and order the book, Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for August, Is God Listening? By Dr. Andrew Steinman. When we come back from this break, Uwe Simonetto is our guest, our religion roundup in the last 25 minutes of the program. He's religion editor for United Press International. He'll join us from France to talk about the Pope's health, the Pope's visit to a Marian shrine. We'll talk about Islam in Europe to begin with right after this.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Does prayer bring God to me? Is prayer a pipeline of communication between a believer and God? And is that pipeline a two-way street? You'll find answers to these questions in our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August, Is God Listening? It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Andrew Steinman. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Is God Listening? Costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Does God decide how to answer requests based on how many people are praying? Find out with the book Is God Listening? By Dr. Andrew Steinman. When you order, tell them, I listen to Issues, Etc., and I want the book of the month for August. The title is God Listening? Issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040.
Army Ants, defying evolution.
Answers with Ken Ham, one of the contributing writers and editors of Creation Magazine. Well, Ken, army ants aren't marching along with evolution, are they?
Well, actually, even the secular experts agree with that. By the way, we reported on this recently in our Creation magazine. You see, the common evolutionary belief has been that army ants evolved separately on several continents over millions of years. Now, using fossil data and the science of genetics, a Cornell University scientist has discovered that these ants all come from the same ancestor. He claims they arose about 100 million years ago, even though they haven't really changed. Scientists also studied specific mutations of subfamilies of army ants from different countries. Now, they discovered that they all share many of the same mutations. You know, the conclusion of the researcher is that they haven't changed much at all and that they all evolved from a common ancestor in one location. You know, once again, the evidence found by secular scientists, except for their evolutionary timescale, really fits perfectly with the Genesis account of creation. The army ants have reproduced after their own kind, just like the Bible states. You see, they didn't evolve at all.
Ken Ham has written a fascinating free booklet on the Bible as the true history record of the world. For some fascinating reading, log on to our free website, AnswersRadio.com. Answers to many of your questions are presented right there at AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. The average American child spends over 20 hours a week watching TV. That means children spend more time watching TV than any other activity, except sleeping. That much time in front of the TV seriously displaces quality time with the family. But it needn't be that way. You can set a good example for your children with your own TV habits. Ecclesiastes 3:1 says, "There is a time for everything." In many households, it is high time to unplug the TV and tune in to your family. Celebrate your life of joy and happiness in Christ by sharing the events of your day with the ones you love the most. And at the same time, you will be teaching your children to do the same. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute at cmli.org.
You're the one who has to take the little barbs and stabs most every day, and there just doesn't seem to be anything you can do about it.
On the next Focus on the Family, author Frank Peretti talks to wounded hearts.
You feel helpless because you don't think there's any alternative.
In a message to teens and their parents, Peretti offers encouragement to hurting souls, defeating the horrors of high school on the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back for the last half hour of Issues Etc. today. I'm Todd Wilkin. Uwe Simonetto joins us for our Religion Roundup. He's a regular guest and religion editor for United Press International. He joins us from France, and the first thing we're going to take up is a subject from France. In fact, the issue of Muslims in France, in and around Paris. Uwe Simonetto, welcome back.
Great to be back, Todd.
Tell us about the situation in and around Paris. The fear used to be of communist enclaves outside in the suburbs of the city, but now that's changed. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is that Muslim immigrants, Arab immigrants and their offspring, moved into those very, very grim housing estates, Eastern European-style housing estates, in the suburbs around Paris. These suburbs were, back 20 years ago, run by Communist Party administrations, run very much along the line of Eastern Europe, with a lot of pressure, and it's very grim. Now, of course, most of these working-class Frenchmen have moved out, and you have Muslim families or Arab families, and there, of course, the situation is equally as grim because it is run by, very often by extremist clerics who preach hatred. And that manifests itself. I mean, the young generation become more and more radicalized, and that manifests itself by wanton attacks on just regular people. For example, last New Year's Eve, they descended on the center of Paris, Champs-Élysées, the landmark avenue in in Paris and smashed up windows and beat up people and robbed stores and that sort of thing. And in some of these places, the cops wouldn't even set foot anymore because it's too dangerous.
So how would you characterize the mood, not only of the Muslim population in and around France, I mean, in and around Paris in France, but the mood of European Islam?
Well, the mood, actually, the mood, we have to distinguish here between regular French Muslim residents of Paris who try to get out of there and who are just as appalled as are Christians or secularists. But the mood is that unless things change there and rapidly, you might get a pendulum swing, and that might be very, very dangerous because it can, once the sort of working class and middle class Frenchmen hit back, and it's usually that side of it, then of course you don't know what the consequence is going to be. I know that this thing is viewed in the French government or by the French government with great alarm, which is one of the reasons why they want to train, want to have imams trained in France who preach on the Quran rather than politics and preach in French rather than in Arabic, and so could be somewhat controlled.
The impression we get over here, Uwe, is that there's a French state that is pretty much at peace with its Muslim population, and the only thing that ever really upsets the apple cart over there in France or in Europe in general are us nasty Americans and all of our saber-rattling with regard to the Muslim world. Is that an accurate picture?
Yeah, well, no, it's not, because, yes, they'd like to live in peace with their Muslim citizens, but they are not, because the Islamist influx, especially from the Middle East, is producing an enormous amount of tension, and it's very, very difficult to get them under control. And I suspect that some of the anti-American sentiments are also linked to a form of appeasement of their own Muslim populations. As, again, I must stress that we cannot generalize, because I've talked to many Muslims who live in Paris and work in Paris and who are equally as appalled as we are. There is a another thing that's going on, which your listeners might be interested in, that is, you know, where I think I've been reporting this before, that there are substantial amounts of conversions going on from Islam to Christianity. But I know of many cases in Paris, in the Paris area, and also in the Lyon area, where people lead dual lives. They are Christians, they're secretly Jean or Jacques or Marie, they're of course of Arab descent, and attend churches on Sunday, but at home they still go to their mosques and still attend Friday prayers and still follow Ramadan, the holy month, fasting, in order not to be found out, because if they're found out to be apostates, then of course they would be apostates, then they would be they might get killed. And there are incidents of people getting killed, have been incidents of people getting killed for apostasy.
So we need to understand the context of that entire scenario, where you basically have stealth Christians who, when they're back in their own communities, their Muslim European communities, feel the need to hide their Christianity and
That's right.
play up the aspects of their Muslim culture at the very least, not to say that they're false Christians in any way, but they're doing this because to convert from Islam to any other faith is
by death. Yeah.
Okay.
That is under the Sharia law, and obviously not the French law. And what this tells us, that in Europe, and this does not only apply to France, by the way, it also happens in Italy. In Europe, there are the Sharia law is being applied by radical Muslims. I mean, in Italy, for example, you find people running around with a hand missing or so, and you know, and these are Muslims again, and you know that somebody sentenced them for thievery or whatever to have their hands removed. And how this takes place, how this happens, God only knows. But it is happening, and it is very, very alarming to Europeans.
But it's not happening in Turkey or in Iran or Iraq, and these people move there. It's happening there in Europe.
It's happening in Europe right here, yeah.
I'm curious about the more moderate Muslims in Europe and in France. Are these moderate Muslims willing to speak out against the more radical element publicly?
Some are. Some are very clear about this, but the majority are not. In fact, this is a column I'm going to be writing tomorrow. I know of some very, very courageous Muslim scholars who speak up and who warn Christians not to allow themselves to be duped by Islamic double talk, Islamist double talk. Let's be very clear about that. But you will not find an overwhelming majority of, or even any majority, any even a large minority of moderate Muslims speaking out against it because it's too dangerous.
Why would it help, and you mentioned this before, but why would it help to have European-trained imams and French-speaking mosques?
Well, it would help in the first place that that there is some you can exercise control. You have that already in Switzerland. In Switzerland, you after September 11, the Swiss internal intelligence agents send agents out to attend Friday prayer services and to make absolutely sure that no hatreds are being preached in during these services. I mean, no hateful messages. And that they stick to their Quran. That would help. It would also help to have to train people who identify with European culture, even though they're Muslims, and who see themselves as Frenchmen, Italians, Germans, or you name it. In fact, the faculty or a department training Muslim religion teachers has just opened in Münster in Germany. These people are supposed to see themselves as Europeans of Islamic faith and therefore quote patriotic unquote. In other words, they do not wish to do damage to their mother country. It would help in that sense, but I mean it is obviously also an intelligence operation, although it's never openly discussed. Because you have to have people checking into mosques who might have youth that might be so suspicious, and also to provide bona fide French-speaking houses of prayer to Frenchmen, to regular Frenchmen who happen to be Muslims. And not to have these people, for want of anything else, go to preachers who then teach them to hate Americans, Europeans, Christians, Jews, and we'll name it, especially Jews. I mean, the Jews are getting very, very scared here, and yeah, it's a very large Jewish community, and you have lots of attacks, and it's very strange that, you know, you have these... nobody openly talks about it. Most of the attacks, of course, are perpetrated by Muslims, although in Alsace-Lorraine there's also a neo-Nazi movement attacking both the Jewish and Muslim cemeteries.
You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Uwe Simonetto has joined us here in this last half hour of the program for our Religion Roundup. We're talking about not only European Islam, we'll also be talking about the Pope's pilgrimage to Lourdes, his Marian theology, his statement on feminism, and the Pope's health here in just a few minutes. Uwe, one more question on the issue of Islam, and it was recently framed for me in this way, and I'd never thought about it this way before. There's obviously a rift between Western, more liberal, more moderate Muslims
And the mainstream of Islam society, which is radical and becoming increasingly more radicalized. Is that rift between West and East, radical Islam and moderate Islam, getting bigger or is it getting smaller? I think it's important to know in the Western world whether or not Islam is being radicalized.
Well, let's put it this way. Yes, it is getting bigger in the sense of it's being getting more dynamic. Not bigger in numbers. I mean, I would still say that the majority of the Muslims around the world are quote, moderate, unquote. In other words, they don't want the war. They don't want to go around killing people. They want to live in peace. I would grant them that. The problem is that the spokesmen for Islam tend to be the radicals, even though they make up a tiny minority. And the reason is that the moderate Muslims will not speak up, and the reason for that is that according to the Quran, they might be seen as apostates, and therefore set themselves up to get killed. It's fear. There's no pope. There is no magisterium. There is no theology department that speaks of any university that speaks for all of Islam, and so therefore the only unified spokespeople of Islam are the ones that are causing all the trouble.
I was looking at the headlines over the weekend, Uwe, and I was noting the way the headlines read about the Pope's visit, his pilgrimage to Lourdes recently.
Yeah.
Most of them began, ailing Pope makes pilgrimage, or Pope health failing visits shrine, or something along these lines, billing to the Pope's health and to his monumental visit here to this Marian shrine. Tell us first about his state of body.
Well, his state of body is exactly that of a man suffering from advanced stages of Parkinson's. He looks horrible. He weakens physically, which is he announced that he had Parkinson's in 1996. So, I mean, 8 years down the line, he looks exactly as one expects him to look. What is remarkable about him is that he has he recovers so quickly, and that, of course, he does not fail intellectually whatsoever. He is very, very tough. I tell you something, I wouldn't have wished to have been in President Jacques Chirac's shoes when the Pope clambered down the steps from his airplane in Tarbes, which is the airport next to Lourdes, and read him the riot act for France having forgotten its baptismal vows and for forgetting its Christian heritage, for being the one nation in Europe that insists that the contributions of Christianity to European and Western civilization altogether not be included in the European Constitution, and God not be mentioned in the European Constitution. I'm quite sure when Chirac retires, he should remember it, at least I hope he do. He wakes up in the middle of the night remembering that one open eye by the Pope's one open eye, I think it's the right eye that has that clarity, whereas the other one is gunked up, staring at him, and the Pope haltingly, but in very, very good French, telling him to get his act together.
The Pope visited this shrine. What was the purpose of the visit, and how does it stand in juxtaposition, if it does at all, with a recent statement from the Vatican authored by Cardinal Ratzinger?
Well, the recent statement authored by Cardinal Ratzinger was, of course, in a sense, a condemnation of the type of feminism that divides the sexes. And the Pope's trip to Lourdes, because he loves Mary, we know that he is Polish, it was to stress, of course, the role of Mary as the new woman, the woman who the giving woman, the woman who willingly does the will of God freely. And that is, of course, the whole point, and not a rebellious woman who says me, whereas Mary says you, and that is essentially that. Of course, as Protestants, we obviously lay less stress, although Luther did put a lot of stress on Mary's role, but we lay less stress on role. But essentially, that was what the Pope did. Plus, of course, as he said, he went there as a patient to be among patients. There are most pilgrims to Lourdes. Lourdes is the greatest site, the biggest site of pilgrimage anywhere in the world, much larger in numbers than Mecca, for example. And of course, so amazingly, there are cures, inexplicable cures, which some of which the Catholic Church declares as miracles. Very few, by the way, only 66 out of thousands. But that is not why these people go there. They go there to bring their suffering before God, and the Pope did the same thing. So he was actually living in solidarity with all these other sufferers.
The statement by Cardinal Ratzinger, obviously with the Pope's approval, how would you characterize its contents on both the role of women in society and also in the Church?
Well, he chastised feminist tendency in making women adversaries of men, but he also emphasized clearly that women like men, are equally created in the image of God, and that this constitutes the immutable basis of all Christian anthropology. That is the essence of Ratzinger's statement, and of course that is very much anti-postmodern. And so by stressing the actual power of women, namely the nurturing power that women have, as seen in Mary, is of course the antidote to this horrible type of feminism that has been plaguing us now for the last 30 years.
And I take it that the Pope's visit to Lourdes on the 150th anniversary of the Immaculate Conception doctrine is completely consistent with his Marian theology, and really, as far as history shows, nothing new for a Pope to do to make this pilgrimage.
No, that in itself, of course, is nothing new, and of course that is where other Christians differ, including the Orthodox, by the way, differ with Roman Catholics. But I did not get, for those of us who observed this, we did not get the impression that that was the main emphasis. Clearly the emphasis was, look at Mary as the example for all women and all mankind, so I bow before her for that. It was very, very clear, there was this movement afoot, there is still a movement within the Catholic Church to make declare Mary the co-mediatrix, the co-mediator with Christ, and the co-redemptrix, the co-redeemer. None of that. There was not an inkling of that in the Pope's message. Obviously, there was something. The Immaculate Conception is something that we as Protestants or the Eastern Orthodox cannot affirm, because it is a dogma that's been promulgated in the mid-19th century. In fact, 150 years ago, as you just said. I did not get the feeling that this was the main purpose of this trip.
With only 30 seconds here, Uwe, right. You have said that there is kind of a papal form of feminism when it comes to Mary. What do you mean? 30 seconds.
Well, the papal form of feminism is to stress the power of the woman. She is the principal example by which to follow. We have to follow. She is the first one. She's the first disciple of Christ, and of course she was the first one to discover the resurrection. And she is to be very, very much an equal in secular life not at the altar, but in secular life, to men.
Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. He joined us from France for our religion roundup. Uwe, thank you again.
Thank you very much.
You know, folks, we have allies. We were talking about that Ratzinger document that came out of the Vatican a couple of weeks ago. We have allies on so many of the cultural issues across the boundaries of the Christian faith. Where are we going to differ with the Pope and his agents? Obviously, on things like the Immaculate Conception, the Pope is going to go to Lourdes because he wants to celebrate the 150th anniversary of this teaching that is neither scriptural nor sound theologically. So we reject it. We say, look, the teaching that Jesus' mother was born without sin carries a good thing too far. Jesus was born without sin. That's where the Immaculate Conception is. We have a human mother and a divine father, Son of God, also, according to his human nature, Son of Mary. So, we don't have to push Mary into the sphere of sinlessness. We have a sinless Christ. Now, I know that it sounds logical to some, but this is where good theology doesn't always make logical sense. So we stand our ground on an error like the Immaculate Conception, but we can still look at the Pope's visit there and the statements from the Vatican that not only decry but also debunk the feminist mentality and say, now that's something we can get on board with. That's something we can agree about. Are we going to necessarily go the whole way with the Pope on Mary? Obviously not. But there are things we can affirm, along with the Roman Catholics, and I would pray with all Christians that we do have the Mother of God in Mary. To say anything less is to deny the incarnation, to say that what was born of her womb wasn't God, but it is Jesus Christ, our Savior. And then on all those other issues, we stand shoulder to shoulder with them. And to tell you the truth, if we saw it in perspective, it's they may be the Hoover Dam that's holding back feminism, and we're just the little towns beneath the dam who are being protected by their faithfulness on those issues. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about David and Jonathan with Pastor Richard Stuckwish of Emmaus Lutheran Church in South Bend, Indiana. We'll also talk about Hurricane Charley that has just swept the Florida coast with Carlos Hernandez of LCMS World Relief and Joe Dallas. I haven't talked to him in a long time. Joe Dallas of Genesis Counseling is going to join us tomorrow on Issues Etc. to talk about pornography. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.